This is episode 673 of the AWS podcast, released on June 24th, 2024.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AWS podcast. So I'm Leesh here with you. Great to have you back. I'm joined by my two amazing co-hosts. Firstly, Gillian Ford. G'day, Gillian.
G'day. It's always exciting when we're doing an AWS podcast.
It's nice when we all get together. And Shruti, despite being somewhat unwell, you've come to the table with a very suitable for radio voice. G'day, Shruti. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling great. And it's always so nice to spend time with both of you. And I think this voice is going to help me elevate my wisdom.
I love it.
It's like when I put my glasses on, I get 20 IQ points. So it's a good thing. So we're talking about Amazon Bedrock and stuff that's been happening in generative AI in particular. And there's a lot to cover. And it's going to be fun because there's some really cool stuff that we've all been getting our hands dirty with lately. And that's the best position to talk about stuff from. But before we do that, let's just give a quick summary of sort of what Amazon Bedrock is and where it fits. Now, it's a fully managed service and it simplifies the deployment and scaling of generative AI models. You know, it's a classic undifferentiated heavy lifting helper. And certainly I know I went from being a heavy SageMaker user to being a heavy Bedrock user purely because it served my purposes better. But there's also other stuff. And Gillian, I know you've been deep in things like Amazon Q, et cetera. How do we choose what to use when? Give us a little ready reckoner.
Love this question. I know it's on a lot of people's minds who are listening. So the way I like to think about it is if you want high customization of the actual models for your use case, I would say that's where Bedrock is going to be able to give that. Or of course, there's always SageMaker, there's EC2, EKS. But just when we're comparing Bedrock to Q, more customization, that's where you get Bedrock. You can be able to do that. You can pick the models, whereas with Q, you don't pick the models, but you're able to be able to have a generative AI application up and going super fast with basically no code. So that's one area. And then another area I also look at is, what is your use case? If you are building a application where you want to use generative AI in your application, that's where Bedrock you're going to use. You are not going to put a generative AI feature into your application using Q. Q is meant for your internal productivity use cases. Bedrock, you can do either. You can do internal productivity or you can implement it as a feature in your applications for your end customers. Simon, what are other things that you would add to that?
I think also if you're looking for direct choice over the model you're going to use, that comes into play. Obviously, Bedrock lets you choose your model. And now also a new feature is you can bring your own model as well. So we're starting to see that. So that makes it interesting. So when you want a sort of a degree of control and ability to change things over time versus take a more packaged approach to things, it's definitely the way to go. And it still brings to the table lots of easiness. But I think there's also, obviously, then if you want to go more gutsy into how you operate things, I think SageMaker then starts to come into place. And Shruti, you're very deeply involved in the SageMaker ecosystem. How do I think about where I fit SageMaker into this whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, you just captured that really well, Simon, is if you are a practitioner or you're trying to build your own foundation models from scratch or pre-train models, existing architectures, so not necessarily inventing architectures, but you want to pre-train it on domain-specific data, and you want a higher degree of control on the compute and storage resources that you're using, that's when you would go the SageMaker route, which is a fully managed machine learning service. And then there's one more layer further down, as Gillian said, where you control everything. And we've got our Amazon EC2 instances, EKS for orchestration, and so on and so forth. We find that for a lot of customers, the SageMaker service does provide them with the flexibility they need while also kind of taking off some of the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
SageMaker HyperPod is a good example of that for foundation model.
You get access to way more dials and switches compared to Bedrock, which is a little more easy from that perspective. So we're going to talk about a bunch of things that have changed and updates and new things. One of the things I want to talk about, because it really helped my world and I love life becoming easier, is something called the new Converse API, or Converse API, depends on how you like to speak. But basically, think about it as a way to invoke models without having to customize each call to the specific model. So as we know, there are many models and many more models. We'll talk about some of the new models that have come out recently. But one of the challenges has always been, well, here's this great thing, Bedrock. I can run my models. I don't have to manage the servers. It's all great. Except every time I make a call to the model, I have to speak its particular language or dialect of how I need to ask questions and formulate my query and all my prompt, etc. Sounds a bit like undifferentiated heavy lifting to me. And so very quietly back on the 30th of May, the Bedrock team announced the new Converse API, which lets you write it once and run it on any model. And I can tell you, I didn't walk, I ran to my particular Bedrock projects that I was running because I was switching between models all the time and I had all this boilerplate to switch between the models, and now I don't have to do that anymore. So it's kind of nifty. So it's really got my attention. So that's been something that's pretty new and interesting. I think, Gillian, you were working on something new recently with the studio stuff. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's still in preview as of right now. But I'm sure a lot of you are wondering, okay, they just came out with Bedrock Studio and there's Bedrock. When should I use one? So if you have an AWS account and you don't want to go through the process of allowing for your, maybe it's data scientists or other engineers to worry about IAM permissions, you want like a separate environment that's not in your AWS account. That's where Bedrock Studio can help, because you don't have to worry about getting model access, which model, setting up the IAM permissions. It's a completely separate environment. So especially if you maybe don't have an AWS account or your team just wants to be able to start getting quickly to prototype something without going through that process, that's where I would say Bedrock Studio provides you that sandbox experience that's isolated from your AWS account. And then Bedrock, that's where you've got everything that's already fully integrated with your own AWS environment.
That sounds cool. It sounds like it's kind of the equivalent, I guess. You know, I find myself jumping into the console to use the playground for super quick stuff, the Bedrock playground, and then, yeah, building stuff in Bedrock itself when it's sort of more meaningful. This is kind of like exposing a more friendly playground outside to your, as you say, your team, your coworkers, non-technical folks.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't have to be like associated with your AWS credentials. So now you can have other people who don't have access to the AWS account the opportunity to be able to start testing around with a generative AI application and with these large language models.
Nice. Now, speaking of models, a lot of model stuff changes all the time. It's hard to keep up. It's maybe not as crazy as it was in 2023, but it's crazy-ish. And so, for example, Anthropic just released their Claude 3.5 Sonnet model only 3 months after they released their full suite of version 3 models. And so this is really interesting. So this outperforms a lot of other models that existed, including its own Claude 3 Opus model, which was the biggest one. So Claude 3.5 Sonnet is available with the speed and cost of the original Claude 3 Sonnet model. And so basically what you're getting is intelligence and speed that's better than the Claude 3 Opus model at 1/5 of the price. So it's 80% cheaper than Opus. So again, this is one of these things about why having flexibility in terms of your model is important. So for example, I'm working on a project at the moment that heavily uses Claude 3 Sonnet. And I was looking at using Opus because I thought, well, it might actually help me with some of the harder things I'm asking it to do. And then I woke up this morning and I'm like, oh, I'll just change the name of the model in my thing from version 3 to 3.5 and all the other little details you add into that little model ID string, and it's a new model. And this is going to kind of be the way, which is why the Converse API becomes important too. Just lets you apply the right tool to the job.
That's such a good call out, because I think a lot of people, when they think about which large language model to use, they want the best. Everyone always wants the best. But then when they're thinking about how do they justify the costs and be able to assess the ROI of being able to use that in the actual business, that's when being able to look at what's the actual price of being able to do this versus the performance that you're getting and the benefit to your end users. So having these options and looking at, hey, maybe Claude like Sonnet is going to be good enough and you don't necessarily need Opus, even though now you're saying that in some cases it's more performant. So that's really exciting.
Yeah, it gives you interesting perspectives on the right tool for the job. And I'm finding this more and more is that there's this interaction of prompt engineering and doing things the way that the model responds best to the prompt, and then the prompt itself, and those things change over time. But one of the things I think that we're starting to triangulate on very quickly is where this applies really well. And some of the use cases that we're seeing our customers doing a lot of is things like intelligent document processing. So understanding what's going on in a document and extracting from documents. That's one of the projects I've been working on for a thing at the moment that's been really interesting to see how little code I can write to get really good outcomes for people that blow people's socks off, which is kind of fun. Obviously, contextual chatbots are a huge thing. They're a lot easier to make now with knowledge bases now within Bedrock. So basically, you can set up an S3 bucket, you can scrape a web page. There's lots of agents that will go out there and grab that information, load up your knowledge base. It does all the chunking up and the vectoring of all the data for you, and you can just start querying it straight away. So that's been pretty cool, because again, that was something, particularly for RAG type workloads, we're having to hand roll. So now that we don't have to do that anymore. One of my favorites is that we can now generate SQL from natural language. Everyone knows I'm a massive SQL fan. It's my favorite thing to go on about all the time. So now you don't even have to know SQL to do SQL, which is pretty cool. And obviously the code writing process, et cetera. I don't code without using some form of Gen AI augmentation. I'm now an augmented programmer. I don't know about you, Gillian and Shruti. Has it worked into your own work streams at the moment? Certainly has worked into mine.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely worked into mine. I use the Bedrock Playground quite a bit. I don't code as much, so that hasn't quite been the use case. But what you just talked about just reminded me of a customer use case around, you know, being able to automatically create SQL queries, so SQL queries with Amazon Bedrock. So Growth Loop is a customer with a customer data platform. And they enable their end customers, who are marketers and advertisers, to use this customer data to then target the audiences that they want. And so far, it has been a heavy load on their data teams to be able to write the SQL queries that create these audience segments. Like, you know, I want audiences who've made 10 purchases in the last 12 months or whatever that might be. Now with Bedrock, Growth Loop has put in place a solution where marketers can literally just type a text prompt and say, give me the audiences who have ABC characteristics. And in the back end, the SQL query is generated and that audience segment is created. So that's just amazing that it simplifies workflows so much. It makes it easy for the marketers. And then for the data teams, they can actually focus on true innovation and, like, you know, sort of pushing the frontier on what's next and how to unlock the next level of innovation.
I think it's a really good call out. And in my experience so far, the LLM writes better SQL than I do. So, you know, I can tell if it's doing the right thing, but but it's doing, I'll look at it and go, oh, that's actually really smart. That's what a smart person would have done. What about you, Gillian? Has it changed your day-to-day?
I don't write a lot of code, but when I do, that is definitely the only way I do it, just because I've never been the best programmer. From a day-to-day, it's absolutely, from my own productivity search, I literally used it this morning to be able to create a recipe for a lamb shank, which I know is
delicious.
Delicious. I mean, there's just so many use cases, especially I think, and for the customers that are listening here, is internal productivity. I'd say like the use cases there's just like so many to help you just save hours.
Since you talked about knowledge bases and how otherwise customers have to take care of sort of the chunking strategy and figuring out the vector database and all of that, in addition to sort of taking over this undifferentiated heavy lifting, what knowledge bases does is simplifies other things like GDPR compliance. I come from the ad tech space, and you know, GDPR, especially in Europe, at some point we know it, right? It's coming to the rest of the world as well. Privacy regulation in some form. And if you're doing RAG manually, then you have to ensure that the data gets purged when not relevant anymore. Whereas knowledge bases just does it for you. So if you purge the data from the source S3 bucket, it is also purged out of the vector database within knowledge bases without you having to do anything extra.
It's a big win.
It's managing more than just sort of the setup and workflow. It's also managing some of these privacy concerns.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And another thing in terms of automation that I want to share is something that Werner Vogel's CTO office released just recently publicly. They released their Distill CLI, which is a Rust-powered tool that summarizes media. And it really came out of a demand that we all have, which is either I was at a meeting and I don't want to take the minutes, or I missed the meeting, but there's a recording of the meeting. Can I get the summary of the meeting? And this uses generative AI, and it allows it to do it really, really quickly. And I use this one all the time because I live in Australia, and a lot of meetings I need to be at aren't in Australian times, and I can't stay awake 24/7. So often I will get a recorded meeting and just punch it into this and get my summary, and I've saved time. It's amazing. This is open source. It's out there. It's free. Distill CLI, if you're interested in it, it's a godsend, I have to say. Let's rotate a little bit in the final few minutes of our chat here around, I guess, safety and how we think about things. What are we seeing out there? What's hot and what's the important focus at the moment?
I think it's like that thread that Shruti started to talk about, the compliance use case, like this is, and knowledge bases. This is where the power of knowledge bases and guardrails really starts to come into play. So here's a real example. Let's say you're a financial services company and you've got your own specific corpus of data about the products that you sell. But the large language model could very well, if you just let it go on its own, could start giving financial advice, which you probably don't want an AI to be able to start giving financial advice. You probably want a certified human that can be able to actually do that. So that's where you can be able to have the guardrail to make sure, hey, don't give financial advice, and then you can have the knowledge base that gives you the specific information about your own product. Shruti, are you seeing anything similar from the customers that you have been talking to?
Yeah, again, like so true what you said, because LLMs can be applied across so many different domains, and each of these domains have their own privacy, compliance, restrictions, concerns. Having functionality such as guardrails really helps set those. I mean, guardrails is such an amazing name because that's exactly
literally,
what
yeah,
are, right. Set up those guardrails. As an example, like if you were, say, building a travel chatbot, I mean, we all know the episode with Air Canada where they tried to build a chatbot and somehow things didn't go very well. But with a product like guardrails in place, you can tell the LLM that these are the denied topics. You can say that these are the content filters or even specific word filters that I want you to apply. And while some of this can be done with prompt engineering, like if you're setting up an AI agent, you can just tell the agent and say, you are an agent, refrain from giving out financial information or refrain from giving out personally identified information. But the nature of LLMs is such that sometimes this can still just scrape through.
Yeah, not non-deterministic.
Yeah, exactly. So the dual approach of like you set it up through prompt engineering, set it up correctly, but then you also safeguard it with guardrails by outlining the denied topics or, you know, word filters.
And PII as well, leaking of PII, that sort of stuff.
Yep.
It's really, I think it provides that extra level of safety. And I think that's what's going to be, now, as we evolve into this space, you know, we're taking a very obviously technology view, but there's going to be a lot of discussion around the effect of any biases and how to protect against those, how to implement effective governance on how these models are applied, the decisions they may inform, even simple things like notifying people that something was created with generative AI as well. So, you know, it's sort of, we're not used to having to maybe put a disclaimer in or some sort of explanation, but that's become really important. That's why watermarking of content is important. That's another thing that we can do with Bedrock is watermark the content we create. And also there's a lot of work going on in terms of the detection of that sort of stuff too. So I think we're going to see the policy aspect, the governance aspect, and the technology aspect come crashing together very soon. And I think what's important for folks listening is to know that they do have capabilities and tools that are rapidly evolving, like guardrails, et cetera, to help us manage that. That's kind of important to allow people to have that flexibility.
And one thing I want to add about guardrails is you don't need to add synonyms for the guardrails. So you can just specify, like, don't give financial advice, and you don't have to give synonyms of what financial advice is. Mm. The AI will just know.
That's cool. Yeah. Because otherwise, then you got to get, sounds like a lot of work otherwise.
Yeah. And I definitely recommend, because this topic was like the theme at Reinforce, which for those who don't know, it is our security conference that we do every single year. And security with generative AI was a huge topic. So I definitely suggest checking out YouTube, looking for some of the content on that specific topic if you want like the deep dives on it.
That's awesome.
One more quick call out, since we are talking about guardrails and safeguard, is that this whole area is, it also goes beyond the technical aspects of safeguarding. The human oversight and governance, like the human in the loop, is still important. You know, having inclusive and diverse perspectives as companies and organizations are building these applications or using these applications. All of that doesn't go away with the technical safeguards. It's almost, it enhances our ability to put these safeguards in place, but it's not a replacement for some of those measures too.
That's true. I think what's going to be interesting is the expression of policy and governance requirements as technology safeguards is going to be critical. And this is kind of what happened, if you think about infrastructure as code when done properly. You know, your governance and your guardrails becomes part of your infrastructure as code check. So you can't do the wrong thing, not because you even know what the right or wrong thing is, quote unquote, right or wrong in the context of infrastructure, but the system won't let you do the wrong thing because it interprets what you're trying to do and says, actually, this contravenes this particular way. You know, simple stuff like, you know, you can't create an EBS volume that's not encrypted. So, you know, rather than say, naughty, naughty, smack, you did the wrong thing, just won't let you do the wrong thing and tell you how to do the right thing and make it automated. And I think that's what we're seeing come into play with these models. Because they scale so large and it's impossible to basically review everything, you need those automated guardrails. It's a parallel development stream with the capability of the models is the capability of the guardrails and the monitoring type work and the model evaluation as well. It's a whole other area we didn't even get to really dive too deep into, but there's a whole capability with model evaluation to understand what a good model looks like as well. So it's exciting times. Any parting thoughts, Jillian?
Well, one thing I want to end with is really how you can start to put a lot of these pieces within Bedrock together into these really complex applications. So one thing, Bedrock agents, which allow you to be able to create these AI agents that can do things on your behalf. But now here's just like giving you an example of how you can start to be able to combine the power of agent with knowledge bases with guardrails. So let's say, for example, you are a SaaS company in the pharmaceutical industry. Like you have like a white labeled solution. So one example is metformin, which is a drug that's a diabetes drug, and off-label uses it for weight loss. But you want to make sure that if anyone is trying to order a drug, they're not able to order metformin for weight loss. So that's where the guardrail is going to come in to be able to make sure, hey, you can't order it for weight loss. You can only order it if the person has diabetes. The knowledge base is going to make sure that what the drugs are going to be used for, that specific corpus. And then the agent, it can, on behalf of the customer, make the request of, okay, fulfill this pharmaceutical request order. That's just one small example of how you can be able to build these really complex applications that save you a lot of time, save your customers a lot of time, make you more productive using Bedrock.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Shruti, what about yourself? Any final thoughts?
No, I think that example from Jillian really covers it. It is about just bringing all those pieces together. I am really excited about those agentic workflows where it's not just about a singular model, or actually it may not just be about language models. It may be other functionality. You know, even just making a call to a software. I think software is not cool anymore. Function calls code is not cool anymore because it's like, just have the LLM do it. We're not quite there yet, right? We still need sometimes to be able to make those calls to functions or functionality that can handle it. So that orchestration of multiple large language models, multiple software pieces all together into a really powerful application is where really the magic happens.
Very true. Very true. Well, lots to be getting on with. If you haven't dived deep into Bedrock, I recommend you do. It makes life really easy. And I speak from personal experience using it. It's a joy to work with. Jillian, thanks so much for being on the podcast. How do folks get in touch with you?
Miss Jill Ford on Twitter. But wait, Simon, we didn't get to hear yours.
My final thoughts?
Yes. I want to hear your thoughts.
My thoughts are get your hands dirty and solve a problem with it. That's been the breakthrough for me. So since sort of starting with this using less easy technology approaches and getting to the easier ones, as I mentioned, you know, the ability to process documents intelligently is fantastic. And then the fact that I could combine that with storing those documents into a knowledge base and then providing an interface for folks to be able to write their own queries against it and augment what I was doing. Like suddenly it's like, wow, this is so good. And it's just me doing it with just a couple of small Lambda functions precisely put together. Life is good as a developer. It makes it really easy. And the other thing that's really helping me with is bug fixing. When I get an error now, I just tell the LLM, what is this error and how do I fix it? And at least 90% of the time, it smashes it perfectly and gets it spot on to the point of, I got this bug in this code. Tell me what the bug is and fix the code and it'll do it. So that's pretty cool. So I like that.
I love it.
Shruti, yourself, how do folks reach out to you?
Shruti Koparkar on Twitter or LinkedIn.
Nice. And for me, it's old school. AWSpodcast@amazon.com is the place to do it. And until next time, with the LLM of your choice, keep on building.